There's never been a better time to become a medhead at michaelmedved.com. It's just $5 a month when you sign up for a year. One of the perks of membership is you can go back and check out everything that you missed on the show last week, including exclusive content for premium subscribers. Here's just a few things you might have missed. We talked about the New Hampshire primary, what it means for the future of the presidential race in 2020. We had on tax expert Grover Norquist to talk about Trump's new budget proposal. We also welcomed George Will, John Fund, Rush Limbaugh's producer Bo Snerdly to the show, and Heather McDonald, who talked about race and policing, as well as a fascinating story out of Montana involving an essay contest at the collegiate level and some outrage that ensued. When you're a medhead, it's so easy to access so much content that we've put out recently and even in the past years. Commentaries from Michael Medved, two new podcasts, Tomlin's Take, where I give my own opinions as a producer, Call of the Week archives, and much more. Go to michaelmedved.com, click on the Medhead banner, and subscribe.
And now, your daily dose of debate, breaking news, and uncensored views. This is the Michael Medved Show.
And another great day in this greatest nation on God's green earth. A particularly great day for the Michael Medved Show. I'll tell you why. Because we have some of the best, finest minds in America who are joining us in this program to talk about some of the breaking news of the day. It is just announced that the United States has apparently reached a deal with the Taliban in Afghanistan, which means that maybe, just maybe, our troops will be coming home from America's longest war. A big accomplishment or a foolish disaster? We'll talk to Lieutenant Colonel Ralph Peters, who is an intelligence and foreign policy expert, coming up on the Michael Medved Show. We'll also be speaking with Daniel Henninger, a deputy editor of the Wall Street Journal's editorial page. He has written a devastating column that says that the Democrats' problem isn't Bernie Sanders. It isn't socialism. The problem is incompetence, core, undeniable incompetence. We'll also be speaking with Stephen Moore, one of the people who helped President Trump shape his economic thinking as an aide in the Trump campaign and an informal advisor to the Trump White House. What about the budget? And what about a remarkable effort that hasn't gotten the same amount of attention it should by the president to try to increase our spending to modernize our nuclear arsenal? Yeah, that's a real factor in the budget debate. We'll be speaking to Stephen Moore about that. And we'll also be talking about the very latest on the current back and forth between the president and his own attorney general. But first up, it is a great honor to speak to Daniel Henninger, who has become, I'm very proud to say, a regular guest on this show. He has an insightful, in fact, a devastating column in the Wall Street Journal about the party of incompetence. Okay, Daniel, this is so important. And what you're saying here is it goes beyond the malfunctions and the embarrassments and the disaster in Iowa. It goes much deeper than that in terms of people not trusting the Democrats to govern. Explain.
Well, thank you, Michael. Indeed. Well, I have to say that the fiasco in Iowa got me thinking about this subject. And then secondly, the New Hampshire election, which was kind of fascinating. The day of the election, sure, there was about 25 people, Democrats in New Hampshire, were going to vote for Bernie Sanders. But for all the rest, it's been widely reported, people were going to the polls and essentially flipping a coin. They just couldn't make up their mind among any of these candidates. And it occurred to me, looking at this, that the Democratic Party, I think, is basically their biggest problem is that they've simply run out of gas. And that the voters are beginning to see that this party is just tired in terms of not just its candidates, but its ideas, what it represents. And, you know, Michael, we're all aware this does happen to political parties. One thinks of the Labour Party in Britain, France's socialists, the Social Democrats in Germany. They get up to a point where voters just go, this party doesn't stand for much of anything, and I'm not interested in it anymore. And this is an extraordinary thing for the Democratic Party, long hallowed history going, let's just say for discussion purposes, back to Franklin Roosevelt, the New Deal, the Great Society. But the fact of the matter is that they have over the all this time simply aggregated program after program, entitlement after entitlement, and it's become clear to people, I think, that they're simply not very good, not competent at governance, at running this extraordinary labyrinth of public programs that they've created. And where it's most evident, Michael, is in the governance of some of the great American cities that we look at today. New York City, San Francisco, Los Angeles, Chicago. I mean, they're all wrestling with problems of crime, homelessness, poor schools, affordability. And these are cities that have been in the control of Democrats for a very long time. And it's a competence crisis for the Democrats. And I think if they're asking, as all of them are, to simply add increased programs and extraordinary amounts of spending, as with Bernie Sanders, that the public is just saying, enough already. We're just not going to sign up for any more of that.
Well, what Bernie Sanders or one of his supporters would say in response to what you're saying is they'd largely agree. The Democratic Party has run out of gas. That's why it takes an independent, a guy who has never, ever been a Democrat in his life. I mean, he went directly from the Socialist Workers Party to being an independent in Vermont. But he would be saying that the reason that all these terrible things are happening and homelessness and rising crime again, unfortunately, in some American cities, and a party that seems to be running out of ideas, the reason all that's happening is because they won't take on the billionaires and the millionaires and the drug companies and the fossil fuel companies. It seems to me interesting. You use the analogy, and your column is brilliant, but you use the analogy that the Democratic Party is running out of gas. They'd say, no, we're not running out of gas. We're moving beyond fossil fuels, right?
Yeah, they are at extraordinary cost. Someone has to pay for it. I do think, Michael, one of the most important events, in hindsight, it was seen as one of the most important events of the 2020 election, was what just happened in Nevada, where the Culinary Workers Union, a big and powerful union in Nevada, essentially repudiated Bernie Sanders' Medicare for All. Reason is pretty simple. They've got a gold-plated health insurance program, which they have negotiated hard for over a long period of time. And Bernie's asking them to give up that program, literally, he says, private insurance programs will end, and transfer to a government program run by the government of the United States. And these union workers are just staring at that and saying, okay, that's the choice. I'm sticking with what I've got. I'm not turning myself over to a medical health care program run by the government. And how many other big unions are out there in Michigan, in Ohio? They're going to be faced with the same choice. I think the Medicare for All proposal indeed is a textbook example of what I'm talking about, and is going to be a showstopper for Bernie Sanders once more and more voters focus on the implication.
Speaking with Daniel Henniger, who is deputy editor of the Wall Street Journal's editorial page, he has a weekly column which is entitled Wonderland, appears every Thursday in the Wall Street Journal. The most recent column is about the Democratic Party as the party of incompetence. And I you could almost add the party of incontinence. I mean, Bernie Sanders, and this is one of those things that I sort of woke up this morning with this reassuring realization. What's scary to people is that in primary after primary, Bernie Sanders has that solid block of 25% of the vote who appear to be Bernie bros. But what I realized this morning is that's 25% of the Democratic Party. At the very, very most, about 40% of Americans identify as Democrats. Among independents and Republicans, he has much less support. So if you figure that out, at the very, very peak, Bernie has something between 12 and 15% of the general American voting public. who actually like what he's talking about. And most of the rest, including most of the rest of the Democrats, are kind of appalled, don't you think?
They are. I mean, they clearly are appalled. They think Bernie has simply taken it too far. And, you know, occasionally there's an analogy made to Bernie's 25%. He'll keep getting 25%. And who knows, it might add up to the Democratic nomination, which is terrifying Democrats. But the analogy is made to Donald Trump, who kept getting 25 or 30% in his primaries, and that people underestimated Trump's ability to translate that 30% into a victory. I think we're talking about apples and oranges. Trump did indeed expand that base and pulled in more people for a variety of reasons, the Supreme Court, the state of the culture. I do not see Bernie Sanders' path to expanding beyond that 25% base, especially with the resistance, as you just described, among fellow Democrats and indeed independents. I mean, in the most recent Gallup poll, which not only showed Trump's approval going up to 49%, it showed growth in general support for the Republican Party, which hasn't happened in a long time. So I think the phenomenon of Bernie Sanders and indeed Elizabeth Warren is just making people come to grips with the implications of where the Democratic Party has ended up. Call it whatever you want, socialism or contemporary Democratic Party. And a lot of people are simply saying, I can't go there once I understand what these people are proposing and what they represent.
Can I mention to you, Daniel, and I don't know if you share this at all, this is a deep and abiding fear of mine. I think I believe, as you do, that it is not likely that Bernie will win the Democratic nomination because they have put in place these proportional representation voting so that you can't sweep as you used to be able to do. It used to be able to sweep all the delegates of a given state if you want a plurality. In other words, if you want a primary with 25 or 30% of the vote, you got all the delegates, which is basically how Trump secured the nomination. But that doesn't work for the Democrats this year because they have proportional representation. My fear is that if one of these people, I think most likely Pete Buttigieg or Amy Klobuchar, or maybe even Mike Bloomberg, or maybe even some new candidate who's foisted on the Democrats at a brokered convention, if somebody rises up as the, quote, moderate to stop Bernie, then I think there will be a tendency to view the actual mainstream of the Democratic Party or candidates like Buttigieg or Bloomberg as much more moderate than they actually are. Do you think it's accurate to describe Pete Buttigieg as any kind of moderate, given the fact that he wants to change the Constitution and wants to eliminate the Electoral College, he wants to add to the Supreme Court, maybe even put term limits on Supreme Court service? He's not really a moderate, is he?
I don't think so. I really kind of agree with you on that, Michael. I wrote that a couple of weeks ago. I don't believe there really is any such thing as a moderate Democrat as we normally understand the phrase. You just look at what most of these candidates have done as they've gotten into the race, early on, genuflecting to the Green New Deal, and eventually proposing policies that are to the left of Barack Obama, which I think was the most left-wing presidency in the last 70 years. And Mike Bloomberg, for instance, he's sort of supposed to be the perfect example of a moderate Democrat. His price of admission was to propose a tax plan that adds up to over $5 trillion in new taxes. It's just an extraordinary tax take that Mike is proposing. He repudiated his stop and frisk policies, which put an end to rampant crime back in the 1990s in New York City. And I think that's the progressive effect. I mean, they may or may not win with Bernie Sanders, but that party since 2016 has moved left. Its definition stands far to the left of what Bill Clinton used to stand for as a moderate. And again, I think that reality is sinking in with more and more voters as they pay closer attention to what these candidates are saying and what they're proposing.
I know that if there were any kind of Democratic strategist or advisor or commentator talking to you right now, he'd say, wait a minute, here's Daniel Henninger. He's saying the Democratic Party is like the Labour Party in Britain. It's all used up. It's failing. Or, by the way, the Labour Party in Israel, which is now not even the main opposition party anymore. The Democrats are played out. How do you then explain that it literally was, what, 15 months ago, they just won this resounding victory in November of 2018, where they won 40 seats in the House and they took over a bunch of crucial governorships and state legislatures. They won 500 legislative seats across the country in various state houses. So if the Democrats did so well just less than 2 years ago, what's happened since then to change that trajectory?
Well, what's the main? Let's that's right. And the main thing that's happened, to put it quickly, is the impeachment of Donald Trump, led by Nancy Pelosi and Adam Schiff. That election in 2018, in which 30 or 31 formerly Republican seats were won by Democrats running as moderates, was set to the side. And albeit protestations from those moderate House members that the impeachment and the way the party was going was putting their future at risk in this election, they were ignored. And just here in the last few days, as the party is coming to grips with the possibility of Sanders' nomination, those people are speaking up again, saying that does not represent us. But the fact of the matter is the public face of the Democratic Party overwhelmingly in America's mind right now is represented by that impeachment process and this continuing nonstop assault on Donald Trump. It is an obsession rather than the substance that some of those Democrats ran on in 2018, such as health care. And it just looks to me, Michael, as if it's going to be difficult for down-ballot Democrats to pull back and say, we're running on serious things like reforming the healthcare system when you've got the guy at the top of the ticket saying he wants to nationalize the healthcare system.
And this goes to what I'll put forward as Medved's Rule 1A of the forthcoming election and of every American election, is the American people don't want to vote for a radical. The American people are not radical in their point of view. And my rule number 1A is that the American people ultimately will vote for the side that sounds least radical, least extreme, least angry and crazy and burn it all down. They will go for the side that does that least. Do you agree?
Up to a point, though. I think we are at a point in our politics where, you know, Donald Trump was a disruptive force, and he was offering disruption, shaking up the status quo. And this kind of underlies my main point about this column, the Democrats being the party of incompetence, that the status quo at the level of big government is bending towards incompetence. And that is the status quo people want to see disrupted. I agree with you that they don't want it overthrown or radically blown up. They want it fixed, but they do want it addressed.
Yeah, but the point over here is that Trump, at the same time that he was talking about it, he was many of his accomplishments with the budget, with the tax reform, with the deregulation, those are all standard Republican policies.
Exactly.
There's
right.
Nothing radical about them. In fact, later on the show, we're going to be talking about there's a terrific piece about Trump's policy to modernize our nuclear deterrent, which is really crucial, and which Democrats, I mean, Elizabeth Warren just today gave a statement about what she thinks is our biggest threat to our national security. And it has nothing to do with Russia, China, the Taliban or anything else. We will get to that. Daniel Henninger is an invaluable voice on this show and in the Wall Street Journal and in our national discourse. You can read his most recent column and other important columns and contributions by Daniel Henninger. Go to michaelmedved.com. Coming up, with the big announcement of a pending peace agreement with one of the world's most notorious Islamic radical organizations, the Taliban, does it really mean peace is at hand? We'll talk about that with Ralph Peters. We'll also talk about this idea. Why do we need to modernize our nuclear deterrent? Don't we have enough bombs and missiles to scare anybody away? And we will talk about, speaking about scaring people away, the ongoing war of words and tweets between the President of the United States and his own Attorney General. That and much more on the Medved Show, coming right up.
Your outlet for outrage.
It's outrageous what's going on out here.
It's the Michael Medved Show.
It is a tremendous, tremendous thing, and I'm telling you, it's going to explode.
The Michael Medved Show.
A lot of people are familiar with investing in gold or silver, but Nick Rovich of American Federal is a big believer in platinum. What's special and promising about platinum, Nick?
Well, there's a lot of different things about platinum. You know, the platinum group metals include palladium, rhodium, and platinum. Platinum's kind of been the ugly stepsister, if you will, lately, of the platinum group metals. Interestingly, palladium has gone up almost 300% in the last 3 years. Rhodium has gone up almost 700%, and platinum has only gone up about 10%. So there's more to it than that, but I feel like the platinum is going to be the next one that makes that big catch-up with the rest of the platinum group metals.
And you need to find out all about it. Go to AmericanFederal.com or call 800-221-7694. AmericanFederal.com, 800-221-7694. On the Michael Medved Show, it is a big day regarding national security policy and foreign policy. The headline from the Associated Press: official says U.S. Taliban reach Afghan truce agreement. Could this be the beginning of the end of America's longest war? And how do you negotiate with a recognized terrorist group like the Taliban? Is negotiating with ISIS next, or Al-Qaeda? And then there's the other question about the vote by the Senate of the United States yesterday, with 8 Republicans voting with all the Democrats to tie the president's hands regarding military responses to Iran. To talk about both these issues, let me welcome a great friend of the show, Ralph Peters. Ralph Peters, a retired U.S. Army intelligence officer and former enlisted soldier, is a contributor to the Hoover Institution's Strategica.com. He's also the author of the wonderful Civil War novel, Darkness at Chancellorsville. And Ralph, first off, what do you say? Is peace at hand in Afghanistan at long last because of this new agreement?
No. Next question.
So, first of all, is it a good idea to negotiate with these folks?
Well, first of all, I believe in integrity. And if we're going to just walk away from Afghanistan, and there's a good case for doing that, let's be honest about what we're doing. We're walking away. We're leaving. But to negotiate a phony truce with the Taliban that certainly would not be honored for very long, all it does is to legitimize the Taliban. And that's a very foolish move. I mean, imagine if when we went to Afghanistan in the autumn of 2001, someone had said that, just wait, 19 years from now, we're going to be negotiating with the Taliban as equal partners, equal interlocutors. I mean, it just makes no sense. Now, I've argued for reducing our presence in Afghanistan to a bare minimum of anti-terror fighters for a long time. Afghanistan's a booby prize. We can't fix it. It's hopelessly corrupt. And ultimately, the key thing about Afghanistan is people volunteer to fight for the Taliban. They don't volunteer to fight for our side. And if the people of Afghanistan will not fight to save their own country, to build a better future, we just can't do it for them. So, I mean, I think 19 years is long enough. But these are related but ultimately separate issues. Should we leave? Yes, I believe we should. I believe we've given it our best shot. And we didn't fail the Afghans. the Afghans failed themselves. But should we deal with the Taliban to put a fig leaf over our retreat? No, we should not dignify the Taliban.
Okay. Is it not likely that the Taliban will never be able to establish the kind of control that they enjoyed before? In other words, that if we left without an agreement with the Taliban, isn't it likely that they will continue fighting other ethnically based militias and warlords, and that the chaos will very likely continue?
You know, the chaos will definitely continue. I mean, that's the normal state of affairs. But yes, it may well revert if the Kabul government can't hold on. And it's up to the Afghans, again, to defend themselves at this point. It will revert to tribal warlords fighting each other. Our intentions in Afghanistan and Iraq were noble. But we were just terribly naive about what we could actually accomplish. Because we were asking people not just to change their government. We were asking them to change their culture. And human beings just don't do that, not collectively.
Is there a better case that we should maintain some kind of active presence in Iraq than in Afghanistan?
Yes. Afghanistan is the booby prize. It's in the middle of nowhere, and it's absolutely worthless. Iraq is strategically situated, and it matters not only for Iraq per se, but we just cannot let the Iranians have it. The Iranians, and I actually wrote a piece for Strategica.com that will be out next week on this, midweek. I just finished it this morning. And my point is that the same people have been fighting here for 2,500 years. The Persians, the Arabs, Russia, the Greeks, now by a great wake of the champion of Greek Orthodoxy, Vladimir Putin, the Turks, who are Johnny-come-latelys, have only been there about 1,000 years. And they've been fighting over the same turf all this time. Genocide hasn't been able to stop it. Massacres, oppression. We're to these Johnny-come-latelys. We're engaged in a struggle that has never ended. People swap sides, but the struggle in the Middle East and the Levant hasn't ended for at least 2,500 years. That's 10 times longer than we've been a country. And so Iran now is intent on expanding its empire, and it's reached the banks of the Mediterranean in Syria and Lebanon, and that's the greatest extent of Persian power in almost 2,500 years. And so we tend to take a very short-term election cycle view of things, but if you really stop back and look at the Middle East, we're playing at the margins at best. And we're not equipped to fight in the Middle East for a very straightforward reason. And I want to be very careful about how I explain this. We can't win in the Middle East because we are not ruthless enough. All the other players, the Russians, the Turks, the Kurds, the Arabs on both sides, the Persians, they will do whatever it takes to win. And we won't. Now, I don't think we should change. I don't think we should become willy-nilly human rights violators. I don't think we should behave like the Russians and bomb hospitals. But if you don't do that, you cannot win in that environment. And in that world of the Middle East, even if you do win, it's temporary. The fighting never ends. And so I have to say that for me, you know, God knows, we've all made mistakes and I've made mine. But I would be glad to wash my hands of the Middle East if it wasn't for the need to contain Iran at present.
Okay, speaking of the need to contain Iran, the Senate voted yesterday to require congressional approval for any presidential military action against Iran or Iranian interests unless there is an immediately pending threat and emergency. Good piece of legislation. It got the vote of all the Democrats and 8 Republican senators joining with them.
Well, it's symbolic because President Trump will veto it.
Right, and they don't have anywhere near the votes they need to override a veto.
They do not. I think it sends an important signal to President Trump to be a little careful. But frankly, there are arguments on both sides, but ultimately, despite my quarrels with President Trump over some issues, I don't want to constrain our president in the fight against our enemies, our mortal enemies.
What I was concerned about, Ralph, and I expressed this, was the message it sends to Tehran. Doesn't this encourage Tehran to believe that America is deeply divided over responding to this evil regime?
Oh, yes, you're absolutely right. There's no question about it. It sends the wrong message to Iran. But, again, you know, I've been very critical of President Trump when I felt he deserved it. But killing Soleimani, this terrorist butcher who is responsible for the death or dismemberment of thousands of American service members, the deaths of tens of thousands of Syrians and others, the idea that we should not have taken the opportunity to kill him, to me, is absolutely ludicrous. He was a terrorist. It doesn't matter that he wore a uniform. Lots of terrorists have worn uniforms. Che Guevara wore a uniform of sorts. Hezbollah have black uniforms. A uniform doesn't automatically make you a good, honest man or woman.
He's still a terrorist, and Ralph Peters is still an American patriot and a brilliant analyst. You can catch up with him at michaelmedved.com. We'll link to his new column at strategica.com with the Hoover Institution. His new book, a great Civil War novel, Darkness at Chancellorsville. We will be right back with a big surprise concerning that Senate vote yesterday, coming up on the MedVed Show.
Do you support free markets, transparency in government, and tax reform? So do we. Washington Policy Center exposed efforts to introduce an income tax in Washington State, and it was our public records request that revealed the scope of those efforts. Help us keep Washington income tax free, protect free markets, and promote open government. Join Washington Policy Center now at the $50 or higher level, and you can get a free copy of our just-released policy guide with over 60 recommendations for better government. Join us at washingtonpolicy.org.
Business books are the ultimate marketing tools that differentiate companies, professionals, entrepreneurs, doctors, and dentists from the competition, but it takes too much time and frustration to write and publish a book all on your own. That's where my friend, New York Times bestselling author Michael Levin, comes in. He runs a writing firm that prepares the highest quality ghost-written business books quickly and affordably. Michael and his team are responsible for over 700 books, including two New York Times bestsellers. For more information, go to our website, michaelmedved.com, and click on the banner for Writing Help. That's Writing Help. Help at michaelmedved.com. I mentioned that there was something that was surprising and I think noteworthy and has an important message in that Senate vote yesterday. The vote was 55-45 to impose limitations on President Trump, specifically in the way that he responds to Iran. And I was surprised and not at all pleased or proud that there were 8 Republicans who voted together with all of the Democrats, all 47 of them, yes, including the two independents, Bernie Sanders and Angus King. They all voted together to tie President Trump's hands. And I think it sends a terrible message to the Taliban, to the Iranians in particular, who it's aimed at, and to the rest of the world, a message about American division that isn't helpful at all. And like Colonel Peters just moments ago, I believe that President Trump unequivocally did the right thing to kill Soleimani. And the point about the vote is that, sure, there were some Democrats that we know who were very concerned about reigning in federal power. Rand Paul, one of them, Mike Lee of Utah, A real senator of conscience, but they led the fight against the president on this. And they were joined by Lisa Murkowski and Susan Collins, of course. They were joined by Lamar Alexander and Jerry Moran, who are leaving the U.S. Senate, by a good new U.S. senator named Todd Young from Indiana, who's a strong conservative. But here is the point that I wanted to bring out. There was one name that voted with the president. The name is Romney. Now, why is that important? Well, the truth of the matter is Romney votes with President Trump more than 80% of the time. And one of the points that I've tried to make as passionately and strongly as I know how is how misguided attempts are to recall Senator Romney, to attack Senator Romney, to demand that he be pushed out of the Republican Party somehow. It's nuts. And I know it's based upon the idea that Romney is so consumed with Trump derangement system hatred and Trump derangement syndrome and offended by Trump's personality and their personal history. And Romney just hates and hates and hates Trump. So he can never even work with him. Well, here's an example of Senator Romney, who, by the way, split his votes on impeachment. He voted against impeachment over the obstruction of Congress article and voted for impeachment on the abuse of power article of impeachment. And that was his position. I disagree with him on it. I would have voted no on both articles of impeachment. However, can we recognize that Senator Romney is trying to do the best he can as a conscientious member of the U.S. Senate? And when he sees a dangerous and undermining resolution like this one that passed yesterday in the U.S. Senate with an overwhelming margin but not enough to override a veto, he votes with the president because it's the right thing to do. Somebody who will never do the right thing on national security is a candidate for president, Elizabeth Warren. And people said, oh, she's down and out. She just announced today that since the Iowa caucuses on February 3rd, she has raised an additional $6 million for her campaign. And she still has plenty of money in the bank, a lot of it left over from Senate campaigns that she has run where she hardly needed to break a sweat or spend any money. And so Elizabeth Warren is certainly going to be around and continue to be a factor up until Super Tuesday. But she should not be a factor when it comes to advising the president or the American public about our national security. Listen to this response from the campaign trail yesterday. It's about an audience member asking her about the one thing she would do to make our country safer. And listen to the senator's answer.
I can boil it down for me. If you had to pick one single thing to do to improve our nation's security, what would that be besides removing the current incumbent?
It's to protect this democracy. It's if we can get this democracy working. And when I say get this democracy working, I mean where everybody's vote matters, everybody's voice gets lifted up. Make this democracy work. Because here's the thing. Understand this. You know, I get it. Rich people, they're going to own more shoes. They're going to own more cars. They're going to own more houses. But they shouldn't own a bigger share of our democracy.
Okay, so how do you stop that? How do you stop the fact that people who are running major corporations that employ hundreds of thousands of people tend to have a little bit more influence than people who are, for instance, welfare dependent? The notion that this is our greatest threat to our national security is the fact it comes back to rich people, that rich people are the enemy. That people who have earned money, I guess she's getting ready to gear up for a race against Michael Bloomberg, who a very celebrated conservative columnist now says could just win. We'll get to that coming up on the Medved Show. She also talks about the need to overturn Citizens United, to get rid of gerrymandering. This is the kind of issue that she believes will motivate the mass of American voters. I think she's wrong. Listen.
I got a plan for that. And here's how it starts. Here's how I think of this. First, if you'd let me do it, I'm telling you, I want to see a constitutional amendment to protect the right of every American citizen to vote and to get that vote counted. Everyone. Fight hard. I want a federal law to outlaw all political gerrymandering anywhere in this country.
Unconstitutional.
How about another federal law? One that overturns every racist voter suppression law in America. Okay, just one more. Just one more. Overturn Citizens United. Democracy is not for sale. That's what I do.
Okay, overturning Citizens United is something that would have to be done in the courts or by constitutional amendment. The idea of getting rid of gerrymandering everywhere, well, that is clearly an assault on a state's ability to decide its own affairs. Because a lot of the gerrymandering that people are most excited about has to do with state legislatures. And you're saying that a state should not be allowed to go ahead and devise its own scheme for where you vote? In other words, does she want to abolish states altogether? And of course, this is total nonsense. None of this has to do with our core problems in the United States, or even the core problems he's thinking about. Look, can we understand something? And this goes to the very core of what's wrong with the Democrats. They want you to believe that what's wrong in America is that there are too many people who are too rich. I think that the problem we have in America is that there are too many people who are too poor, or are struggling too hard to avoid being poor. And yes, government should make it easier for people who are in the midst of that struggle. But you don't make it easier by attacking people who create jobs, who build businesses, who upgrade communities. It's like the whole idea that somehow gentrification, when a neighborhood gets safer and better and nicer with better stores and cafes and even exercise clubs. I mean, if a neighborhood is upgrading, how does that hurt anybody? I know it means that rents rise, but with income rising and with some neighborhoods getting better, it doesn't make other neighborhoods get worse. In the same way that somebody making money doesn't take money away from anybody else. Makes money for the whole community. We're going to continue talking about that with Steve Moore, one of the clearest economic thinkers in the country and an advisor to President Trump. We'll also talk about the new efforts to create transgender rights. What's wrong with transgender athletes dominating female sports? That and more worth talking about in this greatest nation on God's green earth.